Human Services and Rural Health Policy to order. Beautiful morning. Thank you for being here. We're going to have a public hearing. We're going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 388. Would you give us a Sorry about that.
That's all right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 388.
She has a cold.
Sorry. Has several provisions. It allows medical marijuana cardholders to possess no more than 24 ounces of usable marijuana, no more than 2 ounces of which may be in the form of hashish and food and tincture that incorporate marijuana or hashish. Allows cardholders and primary caregiver to possess a 4-month supply of food that incorporates marijuana or hashish and supplies and supply of tincture made from marijuana or hashish. Decreases amount of marijuana that may be possessed by marijuana grow site responsible party to 24 ounces. Creates exception to allow marijuana grow site responsible party to store registry identification cardholders' marijuana if they cannot store the marijuana at their residence. Requires Department of Human Services to define by rule when a marijuana plant is mature. The rule must specify that a plant that has no flowers and that is less than 18 inches in height and in diameter is a seedling or a start and not a mature plant. Directs the department to prepare an Oregon Medical Marijuana Manual describing the rights and obligations of the registry identification card holders, designated primary caregivers, and the individuals responsible for the grow sites, and requires those individuals to state in the application for the registry identification cards that they have read the manual and understand its contents. And lastly, directs the department to establish investigatory and dispute resolution procedures.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Grant Higginson, did you want to come up and give a little overview of where we are? I mentioned to Katie I was going to call you first, so I hope she told you.
Good morning, Senator Morissette, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I'm the administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, Public Health Division, Department of Human Services, and the medical marijuana program is one of the programs in my office. And actually, Chair Morissette, I thought I was going to be the second one up, that you would have Stormy come talk about the bill first because she is the primary sponsor of the bill, but I'm happy to lead off if that is your preference.
Yeah, why don't you do that?
Thank you.
The first thing I do want to say is I do want to say something about Stormy. She has been a advocate for the Medical Marijuana Act and the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program since the very start. And one thing I've really appreciated about Stormy is the fact that not only has she been a big supporter of the program, not only has she tried to represent patients, advocates, points of view, but she's also been very willing to work with us on tough administrative issues and work with law enforcement as well, and I think that those are good things. That being said, I do need to mention that the department is neutral on the policy aspects of the bill. There are only a few things that really directly affect the medical marijuana program, and that's what I'm going to talk to you about today. And there are, within those things, some administrative issues that we need some clarification on and some information that I just want to make sure that you're clear about. One of the things does, and this is in Section 2 of the bill, is that it limits the amount of marijuana that a grower may possess, and that amount is 24 ounces at the grow site. And I think that the idea here is to make sure that it's really the patient who's in control of the medication. How we're involved in this aspect of the bill is that we're required to develop an exception process so that we can say, no, the grower can have more than the 24 ounces in special circumstances. And in talking to Stormy Ray about this, the expectation is that any individual who doesn't want, any patient who doesn't want to keep their 24 ounces at their home may assign the grower to keep 24 ounces. And so if a grower is growing for four patients and those four patients each want the grower to keep their marijuana for them, then the grower can grow up to 96, can maintain up to 96 ounces at the grow site. And the reason this is an issue for us is that all we're doing is accepting from the patient that they don't want to keep the medicine at home but instead want the grower to keep it, then that's something that's easy for us to do administratively. If, however, it's something that we're supposed to make a decision on, an analysis and a decision on whether it's appropriate for the patient not to keep the medicine at his or her home, then it becomes a real administrative burden for us, and we get tied up in contested cases and legal issues. So my understanding is that all we're doing in this is if a patient says, I don't want to keep the medicine at my home, I want that to be a grower responsibility, that we grant that exception and we keep record of that so police know when they contact us that that is the case. The second issue is in Section 5. And Section 5 requires the medical marijuana program to develop a medical marijuana manual to get that out to patients, growers, and caregivers, and to verify in the application process that the person has read the application and understands it. And if all we're talking about here is self-verification, that this should be a pretty easy thing for us to do. We can develop the manual relatively quickly, incorporate that into our application process and into our information technology systems, and that would not be a big burden at all. If there is more that's expected in the way of verification, that we would actually have to be doing anything in the way of education or testing to see that people had actually understand the concepts, then again it becomes an administrative burden for us and one that would be difficult for us to perform. But again, the way I read the bill, it is just self-verification that a person says, and the person would be the patient, grower, and caregiver, that all three of those people, if appropriate, say that they have read and understand the manual and have been willing to sign off on a statement of that in the application process. The other thing that I do want clarification on is that we've actually in the past tried to work on medical marijuana manuals and actually have been close a couple of times. And from my perspective, one of the stumbling blocks has been we have always wanted to make sure that it was very much contained within our roles and responsibilities, whereas advocates have pushed for we need to have more information than just that. The way I read the law, it talks about the rights and responsibilities and obligations of the patient in regards to the Medical Marijuana Act and for us for the medical marijuana program. And so my understanding is that the manual would deal strictly with those issues. We would not be getting into issues of how do you run a grow site, how do you get seeds, how do you get your doctor to give you the written statement. Those issues, from our perspective, are outside of the scope of the medical marijuana program, and we just want to make sure that it's clear that we deal just with the act and issues affecting the program. And then I should say just one other thing on this issue is that th- that as I said, I think it will be a minor administrative burden for us, but I think that at least until this practice was very well established, there are going to be some delays in applications. I think that a number of people are not going to get all the signatures they need in regards to having read and understand the manual, and consequently those will be incomplete applications returned to the patient until we get those signatures back. So I think that there are going to be some delays in applications. And then the third and final issue that I was going to address today is in Section 10. On the manual, in addition to signing that they've read and understand it, they also would be signing something that says that they would be willing to enter into a dispute mediation process. And it gives the medical marijuana program, it gives the department the responsibility for managing that dispute resolution process and also conducting investigations, which not only would be talking to the patient and the grower or patient and caregiver, but would also very possibly entail going and doing an investigation at the grow site. So we have a couple issues here. One is that we think that this is going to be pretty expensive. I talked to people at the Willamette University Center for Dispute Resolution, and they figure it's about $2,500 per case on average that we would be talking about. And so I do think we're talking about the hundreds of thousands of dollars that would be added to the expenses that the program would incur. All of the program is fee supported. We don't get any general funds. So the issue for you is the expense of this new activity that we would be taking on worth the increase that we'd have to see in fees to the patients. The other issue that we have is right now we're a production shop. We get in applications, we process those applications, we get them out as quickly as possible. To take on dispute resolution, mediation, investigation, and grow site inspections is something that up until now has been totally outside the scope of our program. We do not have that kind of expertise in-house right now, and I'm actually not convinced that this would be something that would be best for us to take on, simply because that's really not the skill sets in public health. And so if this bill is moving forward, I would hope that we could get an amendment that made it clear that if we wanted to contract out for dispute resolution and the investigation portions of the new responsibilities, that we would be able to do that. So In summary, then, as I said, we're neutral on the bill. We would, though, if the bill's moving forward, like to have the clarification that yes, indeed, the exception process is something that we give any time a patient asks for it. Also, like to be again clear that the manual that we'd be developing is strictly related to the rights and obligations in the Medical Marijuana Act and how people work with the medical marijuana program. And then the third thing is that authorization that we could contract out for mediation and investigations if we decide that's the best way to go. And then I'd close just by saying that there are a number of other issues within the bill that I did not address because they really don't affect the medical marijuana program. I'd be happy to speak to those if you have questions, but otherwise that's the end, and I will be happy to answer any questions.
What's the nature of the disputes? Dispute resolution. This is, I don't know that if we dealt with this last time when we passed the bill, but what? how serious are the disputes? What kind of disputes are they? How are they settled now, if at all?
Chair Morissette, and actually I think that Stormy and others are going to be better able to answer that question. But some of the easy ones I can see is a patient coming to us and saying, we're not I'm not getting the amount of medication that I think I should be getting.
Okay.
Another one I think would be I asked for my marijuana plants back from my grower because I want to have a new grower, and the grower gave me five of the scrawniest plants I've ever seen. I don't think that's right. I don't think those were my plants. It's those kind of issues that we would get thrown into. And I don't think that they're going to be easy ones to resolve. I don't think that they're going to be issues where people are going to come to agreement. I think that most of the time they're either going to just, well, I'll live without it, or they'll go to further litigation. And then we would be involved in the litigation as well. And up to this point, I'm not sure how it's done. If a patient thought there was criminal activity, they could report that to law enforcement. If they thought that they had been somehow financially harmed, then they could do a civil process litigation.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Senator Montesanders.
Before you leave, I just have a couple of questions, not directly related to Bill, but could you remind me how the marijuana is supposed to be stored, and if the grower has children in the house, teenagers or young children, how is the presence of marijuana affect is the grower as well as the patient supposed to deal with that?
Chair Morissette and Senator Montesanderson, what the bill says is that a patient, and if the patient has a caregiver and or a grower, that cumulatively those individuals can have up to 24 ounces of marijuana, processed marijuana, at any one time. It does not say how that's supposed to be split out, how that could be split out, where the marijuana is supposed to be. That's really all that it addresses, and I think that's one of the things that Stormy's trying to get to at this bill, is to say that really should be with the patient unless the patient doesn't want it. But it really, the act does not address where it should be stored. And as regard to, are there special considerations around children or safe placement, that is simply not addressed in the bill, in the law.
I believe there are laws on the books regarding other, should I say, medications. Marijuana's a medication, and that's how I view it. But it can be used as a drug, an illicit drug. And so I guess I am trying to blend or trying to understand if we need to be working a little bit more on the environment that a child is in, and I just don't know enough about storage of this stuff, or if plants affect the development of a child, or the smoking. Those are the things that I would like to get a little more information on.
And Chair Morissette and Senator Montesanderson, I'll make a time to get more information on that and to come and talk to you about those issues. But again, as far as I know, there's nothing in the law that specifies storage. And as far as I know, for prescription drugs, for prescription scheduled drugs, as far as I know, there's nothing in the law that has those kind of protections as well.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Grant. Stormy, Stormy Ray, would you come up, please? Jerry, would you come up also? We're going to try to keep the testimony fairly brief because there are a lot of people who have signed up. I'm not sure we're going to get through it all in one day. I will call those of you who have traveled more than 100 miles to be sure that you have an opportunity to testify. there will be a PowerPoint presentation by Lieutenant Dingman from the State Police. We were going to do that first, but some of the people are not here who would participate, and that will be around 9 or shortly after. Okay, would you like to get started, please? Identify yourself. And I am going to ask you to try to be brief for the sake of the number of people who are here to testify.
I appreciate that, Brother. I'll be very precise, okay?
Yeah, and speak into the microphone.
Good morning. My name is Stormy Ray. I'm a grandmother and a co-chief petitioner for Measure 67. That became the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act in 1998. I have witnessed firsthand the development of this great program. Today, this act has support from Oregonians that are seeing their friends and loved ones getting relief. But I am also seeing OMA being used by profiteers. Too much of the medicine grown for patients is being diverted away from them. That's why I'm back again to ask for your help. I am a patient advocate, and I care about all the parties that are in our program. Even though you may have heard that my voice does not represent all patients or cardholders in this program, but it is my belief that OMA is here for to help sick and disabled patients by providing an exception in Oregon law to use medical marijuana. It saddens me to see the patients being victimized by dishonest caregivers that are no more than profiteers out to make a quick buck. I'm sure you will hear today many wonderful stories from patients about the relief they have experienced from medical marijuana. You will also hear people testify that our plant limits are too low. Some will testify that the patients should be allowed to be charged for labor. Others will testify that police and government are the enemy, and their oversight is not needed. In short, they will testify that Senate Bill 388 should not pass. I have come before you today to ask for your help to protect the patient's rights and our program. I have seen too many patients that don't have the medicine they need. I truly believe there is enough medicine being grown within our program. The problem is that it's not getting to the patients. The Stormy Ray Cardholders Foundation held a summit in 2008 to try to identify what was working in OMA. We were also looking for what was needed to make OMA stronger for patients in our program. Representatives from the Oregon Attorney General's Office, the Oregon State Police, the Marion County DA's Office, the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, and legislatures made suggestions on how our program could be improved. Written suggestions from all over the state helped us to develop provisions that will benefit patients while reducing possible avenues of abuse within OMA. The first proposed change to OMA will be to create an Oregon Medical Marijuana Program Manual. Cardholders need a guide that explains in clear language what we can and cannot do. It is time to give the authority to OMMP to resolve disputes and help patients recover their plants and medicine if a grower refuses to comply with our law. Many disputes could be avoided with a better understanding of OMA. Senate Bill 388 will define and place a reasonable limit on hash. Oregon law enforcement has questioned whether we can have the resin from marijuana that is often used to cook with. By defining what hash is and setting a reasonable limit based on a patient's garden, we will protect the right of patients to continue to use hash as medicine. Senate Bill 388 will ensure that patients will receive the medical marijuana that is processed and ready for use. Patients own the medicine, and they should keep their medicine at their location unless they request an exception from OMMP. It was never intended that any cardholder should have control of more than 24 ounces of medical marijuana at one time. Senate Bill 388 will clarify the plant definition and increase the size clones and seedlings can reach before they count as one of our six plants. We have discovered that our current limit of 12 inches by 12 inches puts most gardens out of compliance during the growing cycle. Patients should never have to choose between having medicine and obeying the law. There have been several -1 amendments entered for Senate Bill 388, including one from the Stormy Ray Cardholders Foundation. It is your orange one. As you consider each of these changes, please ask yourselves how it would help our patients that need this medicine. At the request of OMMP, we have asked that Section 10, 2B, and 3 be removed from our bill. OMMP did not feel comfortable sending department employees out to inspect the garden. They also felt normal mediation would be too expensive. We will leave the authority for OMMP to investigate complaints and have law enforcement inspect garden sites when necessary. We have also requested that law enforcement have the right to assist a patient in recovering their plants and medicine when needed. Section 2.1c and D are to be removed, setting a limit on food prepared with marijuana resin or hash for a 4-month supply would create confusion and be difficult to enforce. We have been assured that law enforcement would not arrest a person for having over 24 ounces of food. We have been told that amendments have been entered that would allow a caregiver or person responsible for a grow site to charge a patient for time and labor. Patients would only be able to afford a small percentage of the medicine. Excuse me for my grown for them. These changes would make OMA mirror California's law that has allowed dispensaries. Patients would be charged black market prices for medicine that already belongs to them. We do need a safe supply system where patients can find medicine, but not at $320 an ounce. Please refer to the cost analysis of Initiative I-28 when you get a chance. It's on the back of the packet. Amendments have been introduced from the ACMM, even though we were asked by Dr. Goldberg not to. We could introduce legislation on our own, but he felt it was outside of our mission as a committee. That being said, one of their amendments would remove the height limit on clones and seedlings. This would increase the amount of marijuana that could be grown for a patient far beyond what is needed without increasing the amount a patient can keep. Where would the extra marijuana go? This provision would also create opposition to our bill from law enforcement. I'd like to quickly summarize the patient's plight for your review. You know, we're not so different, you and I. We both have medical situations that apply. Taking a pill may work for you, but I have a different point of view. Have your children disowned you because you need this green leaf? They don't understand, though you say it brings relief. Whenever we medicate, people can tell. It's really obvious because of the smell. So many patients without medicine, they don't know where to start. But Lord knows they can't just run down to Kmart. We're a target for thieves just out to make some money. To take advantage of a patient really isn't funny. Growing our own medicine is not so bad. But when our medicine is diverted away, it makes me really sad. For all the patients that need this medicine, please support Senate Bill 388's passing. God bless you. This poem came to us by a patient, Debbie Rowe, a patient from Eastern Oregon. Thank you for your willingness to work to improve OMA, and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have about our bill.
Questions? Okay. Thank you, Stormy. Jerry, did you want to testify?
Toward the end of the hearing.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, Madeline Martinez, you and Timothy Pape?
Yes.
Would you come up, please? And Victoria Hagwood. Hardwood. Okay. Okay, I'm taking the people who have come more than 100 miles just to make sure they get an opportunity to testify.
Go ahead. Thank you. My name is Timothy Pate, Senator Morissette, Mr. Chairman, and other senators of the committee. Thank you for letting us come and testify. I have come to testify verbally, only to say simply that I'm against the language of the bill as it is written, and I feel like it is something that should not make it out of this committee, should be tabled and put aside. There are, I can see so many problems that rather than take up all of your time, I know each of us should only have a minute, I would address at least the inspections part of this bill as it stands right now, and say that I personally am opposed to anyone without cause coming into my home without a warrant. And I don't feel that because I'm a long-standing member of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program that it makes me automatically considered to be a criminal and open to random inspections. So for that reason alone, I'm in opposition to this bill.
Okay.
And I wish that you would, if you could, please table this.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
May I just quickly ask?
Yes.
So you are a grower, and how many patients do you supply for?
Please don't make an assumption, Senator Anderson. I am a patient.
You're a patient?
I've had 24 surgeries, and I have been a patient since 2000, and I'm very interested in seeing a successful program continue to be a success, and don't
Thank
really
you.
Wish to have the Department of Human Services burdened with any more work than they've already got with the 20,000 plus patients that they have to deal with already.
And follow up. So you grow your own plants?
I have in the past, yes.
You have in the past?
Yes. Currently, I have a provider who provides for me.
Okay, so you don't grow in your own home at this point?
I don't grow at a grow site currently. My provider grows for me right now. Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Madeline?
Yes, good morning, Chair Morissette and committee members. My name is Madeline Martinez, and I am a patient as well as an advocate. And I'm here today on behalf of our membership, which exceeds 1,100 members, and we're all cardholders. I brought just a pile of 60 letters in opposition to 388 as it is written. We do, however, support the -1 amendments to try to make medicine available for patients who otherwise can't grow for themselves because of their housing concerns or disabilities in many cases. And we're really concerned with the immediate needs patients, the patient that has been diagnosed with cancer and is facing chemotherapy within a couple of weeks. Those patients don't have a garden, and they don't have the time necessary to wait for a garden to be grown. Part of chemotherapy, one of the side effects is nausea, and that's primarily what medical marijuana, I mean, one of the conditions that it's really useful for. And because of that, we feel that the -1 amendments would open up so much accessibility to patients, and I really am troubled to hear that someone thinks that black market prices would be involved. I personally grow medicine. We have 4 patients in our garden. I'm one of them. And I think that I could make medicine affordable at $50 an ounce, if not less. It's about $400 a month for my light bill, and we're very lucky that one of our patients can afford to pay part of that PGE bill, and it goes right to PGE, and that's the way it should be done, above board. But it is not easy for anyone in this really troubling economic time to have expendable income to be able to afford to pay that type of electric bill. So we feel that if we open it up and say, rather than just your card hold, your caregiver or grower of record, but we can expand it, it would be the next incremental step in the progression of our program to allow patients to be able to reimburse for time and materials anyone who's registered with the program. Any caregiver or patient, it's the patient's medicine, in my opinion. And right now what we do, and Senator Morris said, I've submitted a DVD for you to view of our cardholder meeting. I know you're not able to go, but we have over 200 people that line up to get free medicine and free cuttings at our meetings. And there is such a need. When Stormy spoke of people that are out there and they're preying on patients, the reason they're preying on patients is because patients are desperate for medicine, and they don't have it. They live in assisted housing. Where would they grow it? And so they come to these meetings, and I'd like all of the committee members to take a look at it. It's a really exciting thing to be able to do, but we need medicine, and we need accessibility. We also support the Dash 2 amendments that were recommended and endorsed by the ACMM. But 380A, as it stands, will really, I think, will increase fees. I just heard that they have some amendments to that. That's a really huge concern. And as a disabled person, I can tell you that living with a disability is not easy. And I would also, Senator Montes, I would like to, Montes Anderson, I would like to address your issue about children. Medical marijuana should be treated, it says it in statute, like any other medicine. And we would like, just like to be afforded equal protection under the law, just like everyone else. And children, medicine should always be put away out of children's reach. That's the way I look at it. I have three grandchildren that are at my home pretty often. I get them off to school in the morning, and that medicine is out of their reach. And that's the way it should be. It's pretty simple. And, I also turned in some handbooks that we developed. There was also a handbook on DHS's website that the ACMM and advocacy groups had worked on for a couple of years. Unfortunately, DHS decided that that wasn't their purview to print educational materials for us, and so that was put on hold. But there is the opportunity for patients to download it from the DHS OMMP website. And we've also created one. We got a grant, and we're we give one to every patient that comes through our meeting, as well as the THC clinic, the largest clinic in the state. Any questions? I'd be happy to answer.
The Dash 1, these are not the Dash 1.
No. The Dash 1 amendments are a very small edit that changes from the caregiver to the cardholder to a cardholder, as well as changes utilities and materials to time and materials. As I said, to help pay offset the huge light bills and huge amounts of soil that you have to buy and all the nutrients. It's very expensive, and it's not an easy task to provide.
Okay, what kind of remuneration pay would you give to a grower?
Well, I would think my own personal math that I've done, I don't think that I need to charge for the room. Other people do feel they should charge rent for the grow room. That's a portion of their home. To me, it's in my mortgage, but I guess if you would factor that in, I would say that I could really be reimbursed maybe $50 an ounce, $45. On the black market, it's currently $380 to $400 is not unheard of. And for people who live on $661 a month on SSI, it's just not affordable. So I am not for, we do not support importing the California club system here to Oregon. You know, just our own personal point of view, we remain neutral on any bills that would move marijuana forward, but we still believe that that would be harmful. And in light of the recent Obama administration, Attorney General Eric Holder has now said that the Obama administration and the DEA will stop the raids on dispensaries in California because it's unheard of. I mean, why would you raid these people? But we want to provide medicine at an affordable price, and that's what we're looking to do.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions?
Yes, just
yes.
Real quick.
Senator Mon Sanders.
I was intrigued by when you say you have your meetings, you have over 200 people that attend, and you give out free meds and free plants. Do they need to have a prescription?
Oh, they all have cards. We make them sign paperwork, and we always ask that they show us their state ID or driver's license along with their OMMP card or paperwork that's actually dates down from OMMP and a receipt that they paid their fee. Those are the only things that can get them into our meeting.
And just another follow-up, a physician can actually have his license revoked if he does not store his medications appropriately.
Certainly.
So I just need that to be.
We also label our medicine. The excess is given to us, and we provide a sticker on it that says for medicinal use only. It has to be in a bag and out of public view at all times.
Okay. Then part of the Dash 2's scientific research into the efficacy and safety of medical marijuana. Interesting idea.
I think it's great. We want some scientific research.
We addressed this last session, and I asked the epidemiologist at the Department of Public Health about this, and he said, well, the first thing we would do is take a look at the literature. So I'm assuming there is literature out there that deals with the efficacy rather than going to a laboratory and trying to start from there. So,
well, there is, but they always call it anecdotal. Evidence. And this is a decade-long program. We will be celebrating a decade May 1st.
Okay. Well, I guess there should be some scientific data out there that where studies have been done around the world. So I would suggest that we look there first before we go further. Thank you very much. Yes, go ahead, Victoria.
My name is Victoria Hagwood, and I want to say good morning to the Senator Morrison and the committee. I've been a medical marijuana patient for 5 years now and utilizing cannabis since the age of 18, and altogether that adds up to 42 years that I've been. But to start out on a positive note, I'd like to request that you please support the amendment to the Senate bill. 388-1. While at the same time, I request that you oppose Senate Bill 388 itself. It is my feeling that Senate Bill 388 would be a waste of time, money, and manpower for the citizens affected by the already existing and functional Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. I feel it would be more expensive as well as complicated for the Oregon medical marijuana program and patients who at this time are already physically, financially, and emotionally taxed. I just want to ask you, if it's not broke, why do we have to fix it with more red tape?
Okay. Questions? Okay. Thank you. Jerry Cupp.
That's me, Jerry.
Jerry.
Can I comment at the end of the testimony?
Okay, Jerry. I'm sorry. I didn't. I'm looking at people who came over 100 miles to make sure that they have an opportunity.
Hope is from more than 100 miles.
Well, he. Okay. John Sage.
There's someone else.
There's one named Culp and one named.
Jerry Culp.
Okay. And I would like to go after.
Okay, John, would you come up, please, and then Jerry, would you come up as well?
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, my name is John Sajo. I am the executive director of Voter Power, which is a group that advocates for medical marijuana patients. I'm also the campaign manager for Initiative 28, which has been referred to earlier. First, I'd like to thank you all for taking on this issue. It's difficult. It's contentious. Even on our side, we often think of it as herding cats, and I'm sure from your perspective, trying to herd the cats on our side and the other side as well is even more complicated. So I do appreciate the effort you put into it. I guess I'd like to start my comments by remarking on really the incredible event that happened last week. And frankly, it's what I think they call a game changer. For 10 years, we've had the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, and we've lived under the cloud of the conflict with federal law. And last Wednesday, the Attorney General of the United States announced that the federal law was no longer going to be an impediment to states regulating the practice of medical marijuana. And I guess, based on the significance of that event, and in my handouts, I think there's a number of articles talking about this from different media sources, but I think, you know, I would urge you to step back and look at the bigger picture, because I think Senate Bill 388 certainly raises a number of points, but I think it's really dealing with small issues and still acting as though we can't do better. And I think we can do better, because so much of the way the Medical Marijuana Act has been created and implemented was done because of that fear of the 800-pound gorilla in the room of what would the federal government do. And now that we know the federal government will let the states be laboratories of democracy, I think we can take a fresh look and do much better. And I would ask you to look at the basic structure of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, which requires sick and dying people to produce their own medicine. That's what we're talking about here. And efforts to fix that relationship and tighten it up a little here and there and make people sign a thing saying they understand it. All these little problems, I believe, come from the flawed basic premise that sick and dying people can produce their own medicine. And obviously the law understands that they all can't do that. And originally the Medical Marijuana Act allowed patients to designate a caregiver. And you all, with Senate Bill 1085 a few years ago, recognized that there was a grower involved and exempted that person. But I think now we should take a serious look at moving to a system where, rather than patients having an individual farmer that takes care of them and at most three other people, that we create an actual comprehensive overall system where farmers produce medicine in a highly regulated manner, quality controlled, so that much better medicine can be produced than the average patient is producing for themselves, so that the patients all are taken care of. You have to understand the incredible and inherent unfairness of the current system. We now have 22,000 patients qualified in this program, qualified by over 3,000 different doctors. The first thing I'd say is that the debate about whether marijuana is medicine is over. Marijuana is medicine. We all know it. The question is, how are we going to deal with it? And instead of having patients be forced to produce their own medicine, I strongly urge you to consider a system where patients can go to a dispensary or a pharmacy and buy the medicine, just like they buy their other medicines, and know that it was produced under the highest quality control standards, and create a situation where everybody can get it. Because what do we have now? We have 22,000 patients. Many of them grow for themselves. Thousands of others have designated caregivers. Thousands of others don't know somebody to grow for themselves and are going without. And among the people that are growing for themselves or have growers, there's a vast range of differences in results. Some people try to grow marijuana and fail completely over and over again. Some people designate caregivers that fail completely. Some people designate caregivers that help themselves to some of it. Some people get caregivers that do a fabulous job, but in the end, it's based on who you know, the luck of the draw. You know, this law works very well if you're a patient that has a debilitating medical condition, but you're not actually that sick, and if you live in the country, you know, the law works really well for you. But if you're dying in hospice care or in a hospital or undergoing chemotherapy and qualified last week, a law that expects you to produce your own medicine simply fails to get the job done. And one thing you'll see is that there's a lot of different advocates out here, and many, many different organizations have sprung up to help people. The one thing I think we all agree on is that there's lots of patients going without medicine, and Madeline's organization does a thing where they help patients get medicine. We have several programs where we do the same thing, and most of the organizations do, and that's how we all know there's many, many patients going without, and I just think that we can do much better. There's no reason, you know, it's not that, you know, we're talking about a plant that could be grown, a couple of hundred acres could grow medicine for all the patients in the program, and it could be much better quality than what they're getting now. Patients should be able to get medicine where they know exactly the percentage of THC. You know, patients in the Oregon program don't actually know what they're producing. That's, you know, a real flaw in a medical program, that a patient doesn't know whether their medicine is 4% THC or 22%. They have their own subjective reaction to how well it works, but I think we should do better, and I think doctors should be able to say to a patient, try some marijuana of this potency. I think we can get to a point of those sorts of quality control standards. Let me just start by saying that I hope you all will step back and look at the bigger picture. As I said, I'm the campaign manager for Initiative Petition 28. I believe that's now been filed as a bill by the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I hope it comes before you all and you can consider it. We would like to have input from other stakeholders in this. Our wish would be that the legislature would take a look at this as a starting point and improve it and pass a law with input from law enforcement and the medical community and all the patients' groups. And come up with a system that gets safe medicine to all patients in a much better way. We are petitioning for it. We already have 30,000 signatures. If there isn't some law like that passed, we will put it on the ballot in November 2010. But we are really begging you all to take a look at this issue, because when we do the initiative process, we don't have the ability to have public hearings. We don't have the ability to really get input from all the stakeholders. We've done our best to try to come up with a law we think is will get the job done, and we hope you'll take a serious look at it. Getting back to 388 in its current form, I believe, you know, there's some good issues raised and some some interesting things put out there, but overall I think most of the provisions in the bill make life harder for patients or the grower, and are going to result in more patients having an inadequate supply of medicine. I think the Dash 1 amendments would help, but I think there's better solutions. I think the Dash 2 amendments have some good ideas in there as well, and we support those, particularly the call for research. And let me just mention that, because I think that's another issue that just really begs to be discussed here. We now have 22,000 patients, 3,000 doctors. Nobody's getting information from that pool. That's a vast resource for an epidemiologist, and we ought to be looking at it. I mean, simple things. I've been on the advisory committee for medical marijuana, and one of the things we've done over the years is try to get the committee to survey patients and doctors about various questions that have come up with this law. For example, we have 22,000 patients in a health program, but nobody could tell you whether there's been a single emergency room visit based on patients using medical marijuana. I think we ought to be embarrassed that that's the case. I think we ought to be surveying the doctors. You know, are there adverse drug interactions between marijuana and other prescription drugs that other doctors ought to know about? Right now, we have no mechanisms for that sort of information getting out. And research into efficacy, you mentioned, Senator Morissette. There are studies that have been done. There's been double-blind, placebo-controlled studies done in California, for example, that clearly show that marijuana is an effective analgesic. And we should do more studies. But we should do studies directed at answering what should be the appropriate quality control standards for marijuana, what are the best ways to administer it, are there different strains that work better for different conditions, are there different ways of administering that work better for different conditions. These are kinds of research that we could do right here in Oregon using the pool of patients and the talent we have in the state, and we'd all be better off if we did that.
Okay. Central Growth Site. Mississippi, do they have one still?
They do, and actually, Elvie Musica, who I work with, is here to actually present some information about that, and I certainly think that's, you know, a state garden is an idea that's been bouncing around. It's an idea that we looked at seriously, and we came to the conclusion that it's not the best way to produce this medicine. There's been three examples of government-controlled medical marijuana supply systems. The U.S., all of medical marijuana produced for research and for a limited number of patients is produced at a NIDA-controlled farm in Mississippi, and L.V. Musica, who happens to be an Oregon patient as well, actually has a sample of that medicine they produce, and you know, the bottom line is it's extremely low quality and doesn't work nearly as well as medicine that can be grown locally. The government of Canada had a state-controlled garden system where they contracted to one company to produce medical marijuana. They decided to do it in an abandoned mine shaft in northern Canada. It turns out they produced medicine that actually contained high levels of all sorts of toxic materials because it was produced in an abandoned mine shaft. And most of the patients in the Canadian program reject that government-produced medicine. I think marijuana is complicated enough that we shouldn't leave the production of it to any one source. We should let different competing interests produce it and figure out who can do it the best.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? Okay, thank you. Go ahead. Introduce yourself, please.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that's a tough act to follow, but I'll try and do my best. My name is Jerry Culp, and I'm from Jacksonville, Oregon. And I am a medical marijuana patient, and I'm also an advocate for other medical marijuana patients in Southern Oregon. And I do oppose the Senate Bill 388. Thank you. First of all, I would like to agree with John that the medical marijuana patients I know in my community are currently celebrating the fact that the U.S. Attorney General has recently stated it is no longer the policy of the federal government to prosecute or actually persecute medical marijuana patients any longer. To me, that's a great victory. I've been working in this for a long time, and like John said, that has been the main stumbling block for a lot of these things that we want to do, is the fear of the federal government coming in and raiding us and telling us that we can't do that. I think it's time for us to now move forward to help the patients to gain access to this medicine and not to make it more difficult for them with this Senate bill. I would like to talk about, you know, people are going to be talking about different things, so I thought I would pick out one particular thing in this bill that I actually oppose. I do oppose mostly all of it, but the one provision that you may not, the people on this committee may not be familiar with, is the provision about hashish. And I have found with working with patients that hashish is a very effective way to medicate for some of the patients. It's a concentrated form, so the patients can use less of it. It is easier to store. We're talking about a lot of things about storage. You know, once you take a big part of the actual material that you produce on the plant and condense it down into a smaller quantity, to me that is a lot easier to store. It would be a shame though if we had to make it a certain amount. This hashish can be made into food. You know, we've been talking about the food aspect of it, and it can also be made into other forms such as capsules and tinctures and things like that that Stormy's talking about. To limit this amount a patient can possess would take away the patient's right to use cannabis in this particular form at any given time. You know, if you're only allowed to have 2 ounces at a time, say you run out, then you have to go through a whole big process to make some more of this. And it is time-consuming, and for disabled people, maybe not even possible to do this all the time. It'd be nice if they could just make their amount that they want and keep and store that. It,
having only the 2 ounces at a time would make it more processing time for them to do, and especially if they're sick and they can't produce it at that particular moment, and this is the form that they prefer. Now, on the cannabis food issue also, a four-month supply is something that's very subjective, just like when you go to the doctor and they say, you know, this is your prescription, you take a certain amount of pills every so many hours. Patients have to figure all this out on their own. They have to figure out how to dose themselves. So it's very subjective to say that somebody has a four-month supply. Most of the patients make the cannabis into a butter or an oil, and a lot of the patients freeze that. 1 pound of butter in your freezer would take up a whole pound out of your 24-ounce, you know, pound and a half that you're allowed to possess, the way that that it looks like now with the food situation. You couldn't really have a four-month supply because most of the patients use it when they need it. It's not something that they do every day. It's when they need some extra help, like to sleep that night or to get an appetite that morning. So they don't always just do this every day. They need the supply, so when they do need it, they can get to it. So this would be different for every patient. It wouldn't really be something you could actually say is a four-month supply. A dispensary system would make it so that patients wouldn't have to have a four-month supply on hand. They could obtain the edible form of cannabis in a safe place and wouldn't have to store it. So lastly, instead of getting tied up with these small details like we have in the Senate bill, which is making it more difficult for us to administer this program, I think a dispensary system would be a lot better, such as the Coalitions for Patients' Rights is sponsoring the I-28 model. You know, as far as what Madeline was saying about charging the patients an outrageous amount of money for their medicine. In the I-28 initiative, everything would stay the same for the patients that are currently growing their own or having somebody grow for them. This would just be another choice and another option for people, like John is saying about cancer patients that find out they need chemo next week. They need somewhere that they can go get this medicine that can actually
save
their
life. We're going to have to move.
Okay, thank you. That's all I have to say.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Good. Thank you very much. Any questions? Yeah,
just real quick.
Yes.
I hear what you're saying, and I'm not disagreeing with a lot of what you're saying, but what this bill is trying to do is approach or try to deal with the abuses that are in the system now.
Well, I'd like to see what those abuses are in black and white. What are these abuses?
There are patients, evidently, who are not getting the medication that they should be getting.
That is the abuse. That is the abuse.
And that is what... You need to be quiet in the back. Sorry. And that is what we're trying to deal with.
Right.
And so this is a bill that's attempting. So instead of just railing against this bill, I, as a committee who has to make that decision, needs to deal with maybe other approaches that you have. You brought up some, and I see people shaking their heads in the back, so I think whatever solution that we come up with that deals with these problems, it has to be a collaborative effort.
That's correct. Senator,
okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, we're going to have to move along because we have a lot of people who haven't had a chance.
Okay.
Sandy Burbank and Wayne Haythorne, would you come up, please? And there's one other over 100 miles. Okay, introduce yourself, please. Is he ready?
Well, he said
he would let us.
I'm Sandy Burbank. I'm the Executive Director of Mothers Against Misuse and Abuse. I'm also the Chair of the Advisory Committee on Medical Marijuana, comprised of 11 members, several who are here today speaking. Obviously, from the name Mothers Against Misuse and Abuse, we're very concerned about the issues of abuse of the drug, health issues. More and more people, Stormy Ray said that if you're using your cannabis, it's very obvious because of the smell. But I'm here to report to you that fewer and fewer people are using it that way, and more people are using it in the way that it was used traditionally before it was prohibited, which is in tinctures, in capsules, in oils. You've heard about the edibles. The problem with the various forms of administration, and there are very many different forms, is that some of them affect you very quickly and last for a little while, and other forms, the edible forms, go into your system and can stay there for up to 8 hours. So in a situation where you have glaucoma or epilepsy, those kinds of conditions where you would want to keep the cannabis in your system 24 hours a day, the edible forms or the tinctures and those kinds of things are ways that people are able to do that. We have Mothers Against Misuse and Abuse has three towns where we have clinics, and we see a lot of patients. A lot of those patients are people that are in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and even 80s. They have no idea how to access medicine, even if they are legal. But one of the wonderful things about this program is that it allows people to give their excess medicine to other patients. And all constantly, we are faced with a situation of a new patient who has a condition that requires that they have medicine prior to being able to produce it themselves. We put the call out to our patients, and time again, they come forward to give medicine, freely give to strangers, people that they don't know, the medicine that they need right away so that they're not going to die from the chemotherapy, not because of the drugs they're taking, but because of starvation. And we see that too often happen. So, yes, this program isn't perfect. It absolutely isn't. But what we've seen is a huge number of people all over the state that are willing to step up and help people immediately as soon as they find out that people are in need. I'm opposed to this bill in general. The one thing that I do support is all the -2 amendments, and I won't even go into that due to time. We have just seen Washington go through a process of trying to define a 60-day supply because that's where it stood, and they don't have any official program. And what they've arrived at is pretty much what exists with our program right now in Oregon. They've pretty much adopted the 60-day supply. The reason I raise this issue is when we're talking about a 4-month supply of anything, that is so arbitrary that it's almost impossible when we're talking about the hashish. And the hashish, if you're going to talk about it that way, then you have to talk about it as it's contained in butters and in oils, which can be put in capsules or in tinctures. I am a patient. I suffer from severe muscle spasms. I keep a bottle of tincture with me all the time within my reach, because when I have a muscle spasm like that, people want to put me in the hospital. They want to take me to the emergency room. Instead, I can have a little bottle of tincture like this with me that I can put underneath my tongue, and within 3 to 4, 5 minutes, I'm going to have better relief than I've been able to get from 40 years of pharmaceutical drugs. It is an amazing medicine, and what we're talking about is abuses, and we talk about abuses in regard to the law. But when we start looking at problems that people are having from using the medicine, and Dr. Higginson is here, and I have asked him in the past, are you getting lots of calls from people who are having adverse reactions to this medication? And his answer to me then was no. And I think that would still be his answer today. The computer system of the program.
Now, you're going to have to.
Yes, the computer system of the program is working right now is so antiquated, and they were supposed to have, over 3 years ago, gotten an upgrade. Now we're still at zero, and they are not able to meet their 30-day mandate. If we add many of the things that are involved in this bill, especially the arbitration of disputes. Now, right now, a patient can take law enforcement with them to the grower's house. So there's really no reason to get the program involved in this. Law enforcement can already do their job. If they have problems with sales, they can get a search warrant and go in. And I just think that given the fact that we're already struggling to meet the 30-day mandate, adding these kinds of conditions are, with the arbitration is just ridiculous.
Okay, you're going to have to.
Okay.
Because we have a lot of other people.
I understand that. Pharmaceutical drugs are more and more popular with young people these days. And they're farming. They have parties where they use those pharmaceutical drugs. Any parent in their right mind is going to keep all medications away from children. And it's just that simple. People that aren't parenting properly, we've got agencies that can deal with that. That doesn't have to become a separate part of this program. And the scientific evidence is out there, but we need more of it. And it's been an issue that has been raised again and again. The Governor's Council on Drugs and Alcohol, I've been meeting with them for 25 years now. And we made a presentation to them, and they just did their report, The Domino Effect. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it. I've read it through twice. One of the things that didn't come out in The Domino Effect, but which Stephanie Soares-Pump has shared with me, is that the Governor's Council on Drugs and Alcohol is very interested in the possibility of using funds from the program to do research, as well as funds from the program to use for treatment for people who seem to need it. There's many more things. I'm going to submit written testimony as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Wayne.
Thank you, Senators, for listening to me. I would like to just quickly describe my own experience of this because it touches on a bunch of aspects of this bill.
Would you give your name, please?
Oh, I'm Wayne Haythorne. I have a broken back. I have 3 vertebrae crushed in my back and a bunch of problems in the neck. And nerves get pinched and I start to lose the use of my arms. And I was 1 week away from a surgery in which I would get 3 vertebrae pinned that drive spikes in and connect them up and immobilize my neck. And I decided at that time to do a sort of desperate thing to see. There was no good evidence on this because there wasn't research on use of marijuana for traumatic nerve irritation at that time. There is now. There's a doctor in Montreal who's been studying this. But at that time, I only had some indications that it might work, and so I decided to do a strange experiment to see if there was any amount of marijuana that I could smoke that would deal with my symptoms. And I found there was. It was absolutely dose-dependent. It's the most dose-dependent drug that I've ever encountered in my life. At an exact certain amount, all the pain, all the numbness and tingling in my arms went away. It was like a switch being thrown. And at that time, I was smoking nearly a quarter ounce a day. I was smoking many, many, many times more than I had ever done in the wildest periods of my youth. And at the end of the week of that, I went in. I made a deal with myself that if I couldn't eliminate all of the symptoms in 1 week, I would take the surgery. I went in and I couldn't get rid of all the symptoms. I went in, talked to the doctor, and my OHSU neurosurgeon said to me, quote, "I don't know how you got the nerve inflammation down, but you're no longer a candidate for surgery." As time went by, I thought that was funny because 3,000 years ago in Egypt, my doctor would have known how I got the nerve inflammation down, but that's a different issue. As time went by, the disc problems in my neck healed, and I was able to use less and less. And I'm now at a point where I can go 3 weeks at a time without smoking at all. And after 3 weeks, I'll start to get tingling and stuff like that, so I smoke a little bit. So the difference between the largest dose that I've needed and the smallest dose that I've needed is almost 400-1. So my point there is that dosage is extremely difficult to understand with this drug, and it's very subtle. I've become very interested in these dosage questions, and there's no medical research on it. There's really very little understanding. So that's my experience. Now, as regards this particular bill, I looked at it, and it's a whole collection of, it's sort of a miscellaneous grab bag of everybody, a bunch of people in, got together in a room, and they all had their own particular problem with the medical marijuana program. So they threw them all together, and you've got hashish in one paragraph and 18-ounce seedlings in another paragraph and different kind of odd things. My own particular hobby horse is the yearly renewal. I have a broken back, and every year I have to go in, and the doctor says, yep, your back's still broken, and then I re-up. And so I'd like, if you have a permanent condition, I'd like to be able to get a 5-year or 10-year card and not have to go through the process every year. But and my point is that that you can start off with these 10 paragraphs that you've got now, and then everybody in the state can come in and have their own particular way in which they'd like the program to be changed, and you'll expand it to 100 paragraphs, and then you'll think those over all year and winnow it down to the 10 to the 5 or 10 that are really good, and you'll have something that will marginally improve this program. If you really want to improve the program, what you should let what you should do is let the Department of Human Services get the database working and get caught up on the processing of the paperwork, and don't burden them with any changes at this point of time. Now, there is one change that I would support, and that's what you mentioned earlier, is if Human Services would hire a couple of qualified people or contract to do a review of the medical research, I would support that. There've been comprehensive reviews in the past. We had the Institute of Medicine. You know, periodically the government does these big reviews, and they come up with statements, but they tend to stick to things like saying, yes, it works for glaucoma, or, you know, they sort of stick to simple things, and a real review of the current medicine would be quite interesting. For example, this whole issue of neurological inflammation is quite interesting, and there's really good things being done outside of this country with regard to strokes and people who've got nerve inflammation for one reason or another, and so there's and multiple sclerosis, and there's a lot of research going on, and I would support further research. Other than that, I think you should just drop all this, not waste the time. You've got plenty on your plates this year. This is a year in which you don't need to be making incremental changes to a program that basically works. I mean, we've all got little gripes with it, but. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Anyone else over 100 miles? Okay. Is Lieutenant Dingman...
Got one, Bill.
Oh. Okay, come on. If you're... Yeah. You're over 100 miles.
I live in Eugene, but this time I come straight from Florida.
Oh, okay.
Good morning. Thank you so much. For
now, you have to sit down and give us your name and address, please. And
my name is Elvi Musica. I'm one of four people who receives medical marijuana from the federal government.
Oh.
And I thank you so much for this opportunity, okay. Senator Merced, and all of you, members of the committee. I'd like to speak to you a little bit about the Mississippi Farm. This I would like to pass to you so you can see.
Now, someone will get it. Just stay right there.
This is a 25-day supply. This is well over a half a pound. I get a 5-month supply every time I fly to Florida, which is 6 of these tins. The quality, unfortunately, is so poor that I have to, like, make hashish, make oils to put in my food, and bake other things for traveling or whatever. capsules are great for me too. But I also have the need to smoke because that's the quickest way to make sure those pressures are down right then and there. The edibles make it last longer so I don't have to be worried about the up and down effects of whether I had enough pot, whether it was strong enough this moment or not. So it is a complicated process. At one point, 3 joints a day was more than plenty. But that has changed because the illness is harder to deal with. Mine is glaucoma. I also deal with arthritis, scoliosis, a broken foot that will not function at all without Oxycontin or heavy narcotics. But I don't even use an aspirin because of this. I am really hopeful that you will not pass this particular bill because it has too many restrictions and it is hard enough for people to deal with the program as it is today. As patients and caregivers, I have seen the struggles. Yes, there are problems. There are robberies at 7-Elevens, but you're not going to stop that. You are going to stop it with law enforcement, and there are laws to protect that, but it still happens. The same thing happens with banks. You're not going to close them because, well, you might have to if they're robbing from the inside.
Mary.
But quite frankly, you know, as soon as we're human, we are not going to be perfect anything. The fact that I belong to this program has allowed me to maintain my sight for the last 20 years, and that was only after I had proven to FDA, DEA, and NIDA that without it I would be totally blind in both eyes. I was blinded through ignorance with my fears of marijuana. I let them butcher one eye in order to protect my home and my children from being taken away from me and my job, which I lost as a result of Just Say No, and have been your tax burden ever since. So all this is very important. I thank you for this program. And please understand that before anyone could enter the federal program, they had to prove to these 3 agencies with reputable doctors, records which were illegal for them to keep, but we as patients insisted they kept them, because once you find that you have something that nothing else works for, but this works for you, you're not going to give it up no matter what law you make or what you have to do to get it. You cannot... And you cannot respect laws that demand such, either. So, all in all, thank you for your wonderful work. Keep it up. Know that before we got into this program, we had to prove that this is the most efficient, the most reliable, and the safest part of our program. So stop worrying about how much hashish I take or how many edibles I have, because they're never going to hurt me. Everything that it does for me is positive and has been doing so for 34 years, since 1975. So thank you.
Thank you. Lee Berger, would you come up, please? I don't know if we're going to have a PowerPoint or not today. And I know that you are under some time constraints.
Thank you, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. My name is Leland Berger. I am a lawyer. My bar number is 83020. I've been practicing since 1983. My wife says that makes me older than dirt. I practice statewide representing patients and their providers. I helped draft the Medical Marijuana Act. I have been working on the various amendments. I haven't been coming here as long as John Sajo and Sandy Burbank and Laird Funk, who unfortunately couldn't make it today. I hope you've all received Laird's comments on 388. He's been an advocate from Williams, and with Sandy and John has been coming here since the early 80s. Yeah. I endorse his comments about that. I did want to respond to some things that Stormy said directly, but before I do that, I want to tell you about the concerns. It's challenging without having seen this PowerPoint. I appreciate that I'd heard about it before the hearing, and I appreciate that I was offered the opportunity to testify after seeing it, but I can imagine more or less what it says. And let me just say this about the so-called abuses in the program. The focus is misplaced. There are over 20,000 patients in the program, and Jerry Wade during the 2005 session when we passed 1085, which I hope you recall is a compromise I opposed, and I'm going to describe to you some of the abuses that have come up as a problem with that. Explain that, you know, most people are growing indoors. If there's a pound and a half and you can do four cycles in a year, 6 pounds a year is the least amount that patients like LV get under the investigational new drug protocol from the University of Mississippi. 6 pounds times 20,000 patients, that's 120,000 pounds. Law enforcement, when they testify in court, says that a pound goes for about $4,000. That's almost half a billion dollars, almost half a billion dollars that patients are no longer putting into the underground market. That's a huge bite out of illegal cultivation. And that's the focus, I think, that needs to be appreciated. When the Attorney General of the United States announced on Wednesday that it is no longer the policy of the United States government to interfere with the distribution of medical cannabis, it raises the question that I've been asking legislators. Senator Cruz, I tried to come see you, and I did discuss this a little with Senator Morissette. You know, the Dow, driving down here today, I was listening on the radio, the Dow's below 7,000. It's, I don't get to retire. and the only real question is that's facing, I think, state governments now, especially, well, state governments where there are medical cannabis programs, is is how to harvest revenue to the government from the cultivation and distribution of medical cannabis. In the packet of materials that I should back up just a little bit, I work, I'm a member of the National Normal Legal Committee. I sit on the Board of Advisors of Americans for Safe Access, a national group. I work with all the advocacy groups, with Oregon Green Free, with Oregon Normal, with Mothers Against Misuse and Abuse, but I serve as legal counsel to Voter Power. And in that capacity, I did ask that our dispensary bill, which is John Sajo told you, you know, we're collecting signatures on, we're going to be on the ballot. He provided you literature from Lisa Grove showing that, you know, we have a chance to, it looks like we can win that. And I want to, I'm excited to tell you, obviously, that contemporaneous with this hearing today at the Senate Judiciary Committee, the committee is introducing as a committee bill the dispensary initiative. And I forgive me because, you know, except for law enforcement and the Department of Human Services, none of us who lobby on this issue are paid for our lobbying, so I don't know. But there isn't any reason why that couldn't be heard as a part of 388, is there? Could I inquire, Mr. Chairman? The fact that it's been introduced as a committee bill in a different committee, does that preclude consideration as an amendment?
Are they hearing the bill today?
No, sir. What they're doing today, today's the last day for bills to be sponsored, and the committee agreed to sponsor the bill.
Okay.
And so it's dropping today is all.
Okay. We'll talk to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to point out, and so anyway, that's what I think ought to happen. I think this committee ought to consider the dispensary bill. You know, there have been some legitimate concerns raised by other advocates about it. There are things that could perhaps be improved in the language, and there are ways that you could, I think, harvest funds. Similarly, you know, the first sheet is the memo from Grove about Initiative 28, but the second is a memorandum about the employment issue, which is addressed in the Dash 2 amendments. And the third shows that the a majority of Oregon voters support the act, 2 out of 3. As best I can tell, the only people who are opposed to it or think there's a problem of it just walked in the room. And perhaps, Mr. Chairman, if you would, I'd ask that you allow them to show their film or their PowerPoint and that I'd be allowed to continue my testimony after they show it. Okay. Would you allow that?
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Are you ready to... Okay. Now, let's keep the response down, please, because we don't want any applause or negative response at all. That's not... I didn't say anything the first couple times, but please do not respond one way or the other to people's testimony. Please. Thank you. Are you ready to do the PowerPoint? Let's do it. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to... Well, I think I got to everybody over 100 miles. There are still people left to testify. We may carry over on Wednesday, but we're going to hear the PowerPoint right now, and that will probably do it. A brief response after it's over. Okay, you want to enter, Lieutenant...
I'll go ahead and do that if I may, Mr. Chair. Thank you. My name is Katie Suver. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm a deputy district attorney in Marion County. Seated immediately to my left is the chief of police for the city of Salem, Jerry Moore. And then to my right is Lieutenant Mike Dingeman from Oregon State Police.
Okay. Thank you.
The, what we would like to do if
dim the lights a little.
This is all right with the committee is show a PowerPoint presentation that has been the result of a work group that we put together from the Oregon District Attorneys Association, from the Department of Justice, from the Chiefs of Police Association, the Sheriff's Association, and from Oregon State Police. And what we have tried to do with this work group is attempt to identify the specific issues that we see with the Medical Marijuana Act, and then attempt to come up with solutions, not just throw out the problems, but actually come up with some solutions. Later on today, our work group that we've put together is going to be introducing five separate bills that address this issue. And just so the committee is aware, Senate Bill 388 is something that particularly the three folks that you see in front of you today have been working closely with the Stormy Ray Cardholders Foundation. We have met with them on several occasions. We have had several discussions about not only Senate Bill 388, but also our bills that we intend to introduce. And I do have, at the end of this, a couple of comments about 388, which I will tell you we support almost in its totality with a couple of specific issues that we would like to continue to work on and seek amendments on. But what we want to focus on with this particular PowerPoint is exactly what we focused on in our committee. And that is a belief that we need to begin treating medical marijuana like it is medicine, and that we need to protect patients in this program. So the focus of our work group was to look at the statute, not just one section at a time, but in its whole, in totality, look at the statute and look at ways that we can make changes that begin to treat this in line with medicine and continue to protect patients within the program. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Lieutenant Dingeman, and he's going to go through the PowerPoint and provide the facts that are in it.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, as Katie said, I'm Mike Dingeman with the Oregon State Police. And unlike the other organizations that are represented here today, I just wanted to go on the record as, since I represent a state agency, the state police is neutral with regards to 388. As Katie said, the common theme through this is to protect the patients, treat it like medicine. And when we sat down and talked about the problems and try and group them into how to educate you all, they're going to have to make the policy decisions. So these are the kind of the clear and overriding characterizations of the problems. And first of all, there's absolutely no program oversight other than just the registry card system that Health Department administers. There's extremely limited access to the records that the Health Department manages. And although we've always had abuse in the Act, what we are seeing now is what I would characterize as significant abuse. We believe that it's gotten to the point where it's above and beyond what is reasonable.
Excuse me. Well, we have copies of this. We don't have them right now, right?
Yes. We do have copies of this.
Oh, if you could distribute the copies. If you have extra copies, we'd like to have them.
Sure.
Up here.
Thank you. Right now?
If you have them. If you don't have enough copies for everyone, we'll get them later, but that way we don't have to take notes from scratch. We can just follow along and take notes. Thank you. Thank you.
And again, lastly, the thing that we're hearing continuously now, and law enforcement hears about it more and more, and then we hear it through other avenues, is that the victimization of the patient. So again, That was the core problems that were associated with what we've been seeing. If you look at the preamble within the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, there's three different things that you can pull out of the act and that in terms of what the intent is and why marijuana should be treated like other medicines. Two, patients should be allowed to use small amounts of marijuana. And three, only make those changes necessary to protect doctors and patients. And you have to start with the premise that the possession of marijuana, the manufacture, delivery of marijuana is unlawful in Oregon, but for this narrow exception that we have within the act. And what we're seeing now is not a narrow exception. I think we see it as a big gaping hole. If you look at the website from the health department from January of 2009, there were 21,500 patients, 10,400 caregivers, and 2,200 pending applications. And I'm told by the health department that you can add that number to the patient count, so you're roughly looking at about 23,000 plus patients. Since January 1st of 2008, we've had 7,800 new patients that have come into the program. And that number, if you go back to January of 2006, when 1085 was put into effect, the number of patients in the program has doubled. The other thing that we wanted to make note of is that there's absolutely no restriction on the number of patients that can be assigned to a caregiver. Although there's been restrictions placed in other areas in terms of cardholders, nothing with regards to how many patients a caregiver can have. The other thing you look at from the website is that as of January, there were 2,847 attending physicians that have recommended the use of marijuana in Oregon. And you look at the definition of an attending physician, it means the person who has the primary responsibility for the care and treatment of the patient. So again, primary responsibility for the care and treatment of the patient. When we start breaking down that 2,847 recommendations, there's 10 physicians statewide that have recommended over 75% of those, you know, 23,000 recommendations. And if you break that down a little bit further, there's one physician in particular that has made over 7,500 recommendations, which equates to 35% of all the recommendations in the act. So if you were to look at busting that out over a year period, if that particular physician was working 52 weeks a year, 5 days a week, never took a day off, and never took a holiday, that person would have to see 29 patients per day, one time a year. So the question that that we have when we start looking at that is, how is it possible for a person to be an attending physician for 7,500 plus patients that are supposed to have a debilitating condition and be really sick and provide for their primary care and treatment?
Now, I understand that particular physician is not working anymore. Is that true?
This number here is based on 2008, or as of January 1st of 2009.
There is a physician out there right now who has?
Yes.
Okay.
So this is a current physician.
Okay.
Same with the 10 that are accounting for over 75% of all the recommendations.
Okay. Thank you.
So just a little bit of review in terms of when we talk about with the possession limits. A patient and a caregiver can possess in combination no more than six plants, 18 seedlings or starts, or 24 ounces of usable marijuana. And when we talk about typical plants, at least what we see when we show up at these grow sites, typically anywhere from a half pound to a pound a plant, an indoor plant more in the half pound range, or an outdoor plant more in the pound range. So its potential at the time of harvest, you could be looking at in that 4.5 to 7.5 pounds potential marijuana that would be available. Now we add in the person responsible for the grow site, and a person responsible for a grow site can grow for up to four more people. So you multiply that all out by four, so that person could be in possession of 24 plants, 72 seedlings or starts, or up to 6 pounds of dry usable marijuana at any given time. And again, if we go back and look at those half pound to 1 pound typical plant sizes, those, you know, you could be looking at potentially about 18 to 30 pounds. This is an example of what we are beginning to see, particularly with the outdoor grows, of what we're beginning to see more and more of. This is a legal grow, and these are trees. These are plants that are pushing 8 feet tall, 6 feet wide, and we've got some red things there that we'll kind of put that in perspective here because the overhead shot isn't revealing. But Each of those plants there is capable of putting out multiple pounds of marijuana. And what you've been hearing today, or at least from what I heard earlier, is that patients aren't having access to marijuana. They're complaining that they aren't getting it. I think Stormy talked to you a little bit about the caregiver and the person responsible for the birth site abuse that was occurring, where they're only getting limited amounts of marijuana from that caregiver and grower, if at all. Yet these plants are putting out pounds and pounds and pounds, so the question, where is it all going?
And now, excuse me, that is a current grow site?
Yes, at the time this picture was taken.
And you say that was a legal or illegal?
Legal.
A legal grow site?
By plant count.
And those green things that look like trees are?
Marijuana plants.
Marijuana plants.
This is what we are seeing more and more and more of as this act is aged with regards to the outdoor plants. Okay, when we go back and we look at what the group that worked on Senate Bill 1085, the purpose of 1085 is, prior to that, the same issues we're talking about today. There was abuse in the act. There was confusion on the parts of the cardholders as well as law enforcement on how to administer the act, how to be in compliance, how to enforce it. So a work group had gotten together and had worked on, how can we make changes that provide for some clear, bright lines for both the cardholders and enforcement, so that everybody that wanted to be in compliance could be in compliance. And what we've learned now that 1085 has been in effect for 3 years, that it did help in some areas. There are some areas within the Act that provided some clear, bright lines for everybody. But abuse in other areas has skyrocketed significantly. One of the problems that we identified, as I mentioned in that first slide, was that is the limitations to which DHS is able to provide information, and these are statutory limitations. When law enforcement calls in to verify the status on a cardholder, whether it's the patient, the caregiver, or the grower, if it's over the LEDS terminal, all we get is a yes or no. We don't get how many cards are at the site or anything about who any of those people are. If we call in during regular business hours, we at least will still only get a yes or no, but we'll get how many cards are associated either with that person or the address, but no information with regards to who any of the people are in the mix in that patient, caregiver, person responsible for the grow site cycle. Here's an example to illustrate what I'm talking about. In the red circle there, you'll see this is a caregiver, and we'll come in, just assume for the sake of this example, that this person has in possession currency, scales, packaging material. This person happens to be a patient or is a caregiver for three patients, and each patient can have their own grower. So that would be the cycle of people that would be associated with this caregiver. That caregiver can possess up to 72 ounces of dry usable marijuana. If it weren't for the caregiver card, this person would likely be arrested and be heading to jail for the delivery of marijuana. But having that card, this person slides into the exception, and there isn't anything law enforcement can do. We know, based on the complaints that we receive, as well as things we've heard from patients, that sometimes these caregivers that are running around, they're using the ones that are, and we're not talking about the people in the program legitimately. Everything here is not talking about any of the patients that are in here and trying to comply with the law. This is all geared towards those that are using the act as cover for illicit activity. So when we go back and look at this, if any one of these three patients is the one that we've been talking about that's being victimized by the caregiver or grower, this patient may not be getting hardly any marijuana, if at any, or they're being even though it says may reimburse for costs associated with the grow site, that caregiver won't, or grower in some cases, will not pass any of that marijuana to that patient without some payment in return. Or this patient may not even have hardly any kind of relationship with that caregiver. So the caregiver's out peddling dope. And of course, I'm going to show you a little bit of this, but we've got a lot of examples of this. If you had access to more information, or if you had this caregiver and you were to talk to and you could find out who that patient was, then you could confirm or deny whether or not this caregiver was compliant with the act. Given this scenario here, this is an example of something law enforcement can't do anything about. And you can see on the left there some of the possession amounts that we're talking about. When we only go to one site, we don't know if the grower or the patient has the 24 ounces or if all three of them do, because remember, combined, they can only have 24 ounces amongst the three of them. This is an example of some of the limitations we're seeing, and this one, this example speaks to when a patient gets a recommendation from the doctor to use medical marijuana. As soon as they submit that application to the health department, they're now they can possess marijuana legally and subject to those possession limits that we're talking about. And it takes health department a period of time to process that application. And when law enforcement calls in, we're having numerous examples where we call and we get a negative hit, that the person's not in the program. Yet when we go have contact with them to find out that they are in the program. And one of the examples of where that's been a problem is when these applications are pending, because it'll be, if you've got 2,000 plus applications sitting in a pile, health department's not checking that pile. So if they're in that list and we happen to start an investigation where we're looking at someone on a grow during that period of time, we're going to get a negative hit and we're going to be moving forward as though it's an illicit operation. This is an example of one of those occurrences. August 2nd, we receive an anonymous tip regarding an elaborate grow. The checks are done through health department by resident and by address, and we get a negative hit. So a search warrant is written and served. The door is keyed. Again, it's a dynamic forced entry. And once we get there, we find out it's a compliant medical marijuana grow. The person has a caregiver card pending with health department. What this does, when we allow this hole, if you say, in this period of window while a person's application is being confirmed as whether or not it's going to be approved or not, is that if we get that negative hit, we're going to move forward as though it's an unlawful grow, and we're going to treat it just like we do anything else. And if we're executing a search warrant, we already know that these indoor grows and outdoor grows have been subjects of, you know, home invasions. There's been violence associated with them. These cardholders are already going to be on a little bit of high alert. Bad things can happen when we execute search warrants. So you're putting both the cardholder and law enforcement at risk when we shouldn't be at risk. And in a situation like this, there's probably lawsuits coming, you know, from this caregiver, and rightfully so. They weren't doing anything wrong.
I don't understand why we didn't limit caregivers. Four caregivers, we had. A grower can only grow for four patients. Now, the bill says four caregivers. We would change it to four caregivers, and what you're saying is we have unlimited numbers of caregivers out there.
Senator Morissette, what you have currently is a caregiver, a patient, a caregiver, and a person responsible for a grow site can't grow for more than four people.
Yeah.
All three. A caregiver is not limited in the number of patients that they can have assigned to them. They wouldn't be able to grow for an unlimited number of people. They would only be able to grow for four.
That's what is in this bill.
That's what we have currently.
Well, the numbers don't seem to add up. There seem to be more caregivers than we need.
There's a lot of caregivers. And I think that's one of the things that we're talking about. There's absolutely no mechanism for oversight over whether a person gets designated a caregiver. And I'll hit on this just a little bit more
as we move forward. That's what I was trying to say, yes.
Correct. The other thing is we are attracting criminals from out of state that are coming to Oregon and using, and these are drug dealers, professional drug dealers that are coming here to use the act. And we've got a couple of examples of that. We could flood you with examples if you wanted them, but for purposes of the presentation, we've just picked out examples that will reflect the problem that we're trying to show you what we're seeing. This is a person here that was picked up on, he was a federal fugitive. He came here from Texas and had federal arrest warrants for him for drug trafficking methamphetamine. So he comes to Oregon and applies to Oregon, and he gets a card. He's picked up on the federal warrant, has 92 plants in possession, and he's legal in regards to the Oregon medical marijuana. And the reason he's legal is there's a provision from 1085 that makes it unlawful for an Oregon participant to be either a caregiver or a grower if they've been convicted of a, you know, Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 A or B felony for manufacture or delivery. That doesn't apply to anybody outside the state of Oregon. So anybody that comes here with any of those types of criminal backgrounds can get a card, whereas if you're an Oregonian, you can't. Of course, the patients can get the cards regardless. They're just limited to the ounce if they've got those convictions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Does this bill address that?
Chair Morissette, Senator Anderson, not 388 does not address that in its current form.
And do we have legislation that will address that?
Yes, if I may, Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, one of the bills that our committee is introducing today will address that specific issue. And it is something that the District Attorneys Association and law enforcement requested in 2007, and I think in an effort to see where 1085 was going to take us, there was a decision made to hold off on that, but we have introduced that in our bill. Thank you.
Excuse me. Where is your bill right now? I understand that Senator Morris has a number of bills that I don't know anything about, which makes it kind of frustrating. If we're dealing with a comprehensive medical marijuana bill and there are other bills floating around, it makes it very difficult.
Mr. Chair, the only information that I have is that my understanding is, and forgive me if I don't have all the information, that the bills have to be filed by noon today, and that they are going to be filed by noon today. And I apologize that I do not have the answer to the second part of your question.
Okay.
This next example is another example of an out-of-state person, and in this particular that came here and had drug warrants from another state. It just happens to be Texas again, and this person was in violation. Had 69 plants, 53 seedlings, and what this person had done is come to Oregon, got a false name under an Oregon ID card, and then submitted his applications. And the only reason we found out about him is when he was arrested for being out of compliance with the act, and we did his fingerprints, we were able to figure out who he was. In this particular case, there isn't anything we can do with this person in terms of health department, no matter what law we pass. This is just a further example of what we wanted to show of someone from out of state coming in to take advantage of the act for illicit activity. Now, this drug trafficker was using the OMMA as a front. And what he's holding in his right hand there is a wad of an undisclosed amount of currency. In October of 06, he was found to be in possession of 12 pounds. Told police he was a patient and a caregiver, so he could legally possess 3 pounds, a pound and a half for each one of those cards. As the law was as it is now, is we can only seize the excess, so we took the 9 pounds. He was left with the 3. While that case is continuing, he continues to on with his drug dealing, and over the next 3 months, law enforcement is buying marijuana from him, which results in a search warrant that's executed at his residence, where, again, he's in excess both in quantity of dry usable marijuana and the plants, and of course, this is a polydrug guy. We also ended up with some methamphetamine. This picture that you're looking at now is a picture that was seized when that search warrant was executed at his house. This next photo is another picture that was seized at his house, and this is his son watering the plants. The reason that we wanted to bring your attention to this, and I think there was a question earlier where this was being discussed, it's law enforcement's belief that it's not the legitimate people in this program that are the problem. They're doing their best. They're trying to comply with the law and the act to the best of their ability based on the information that they're given, and that if they're trying to be responsible, they're not going to expose their children to these grow sites and marijuana laying around, whereas the drug dealers, the people that are in there illicitly, are more apt to do that, like in this particular case. The other thing that law enforcement is beginning to deal with more with these grow sites is across the country we're having a lot more discussions about safety when we respond to them, process them, and take down these plants, because we're starting to have examples of law enforcement getting sick. So we're now, just like we did with Klan Labs, with site safety officers, you're starting to see some classes and some training and gear that how we can process these because of the molds, the mildews, the funguses, the insecticides, you know, the varying chemicals that are used in these grow sites. So, but again, the focus of this was to demonstrate that if we're able to root out the level of abuse that's in this act now, then maybe we wouldn't see so much of this. Some examples of just the drug trafficking, again, in the interest of time, I could bring in the Drug Task Force commander and others, and they could tell you stories all day long. But here's a case where Utah State Police, and this is marijuana that's, you know, when we were talking about where's it going, well, here, this is an example. It's going out of state. Utah picks off 13 pounds. It's pays $47,000 for it. The individual cooperates and tells us who he bought it from, which results in us doing a knock and talk at this person's residence. And while the officers are there, two or three other people come and try and start or come to the house while the detectives are there to try and buy marijuana from him. The next example is a caregiver. This person's a caregiver for two. This person was very cooperative with us, at least initially, in terms of telling us this is how we do it. He had 15 pounds, and law enforcement had been aware of him for a while. It just took a while before we could make a case. He had 15 pounds of bulk marijuana at the time. He admitted to selling 80 to 90 pounds per year, anywhere from 3,200 to 4,200 a pound, depending on whether the marijuana was coming from an indoor grow or an outdoor grow. And he was recruiting 18 or 19-year-olds to get caregiver cards as well to help him sell. The thing that he said is with the two patients that he had, he said one patient he never gave a single drop of marijuana to, and the other one he just gave him an ounce or two every once in a while. He simply had the card so that he could deal drugs. The next is a caregiver that was arrested after arranging to sell 50 pounds for $125,000. This person also happened to run a nonprofit medical marijuana organization. And the last example here is was a cardholder that was attempting to smuggle 67 pounds to Minnesota. We worked that case on both ends, and both here on the Oregon side and the Minnesota side, and ended up with another 80,000. And the source of that marijuana is a medical marijuana card holder here in Oregon. And we're starting to see, again, more. This is happening more and more and more in our investigations. We were talking about caregivers a little bit earlier in terms of there's no limitation in the current act as to how many patients can be assigned to a particular caregiver. So it's important to go back and look at what the act actually says about what the roles and responsibility of a caregiver is, and that is that you have significant responsibility for managing the well-being of a patient. Again, significant responsibility for managing the well-being of a patient. So we looked at this, and there's a person in the program that's a patient for himself. He's a grower for three others, and he's a caregiver for 26 patients. And I guess the question we have is, how is that possible? How can you possibly provide, significant responsibility for managing the well-being of a person, and be growing all this marijuana and being a patient who has a debilitating condition yourself? And this is the growth site that's associated with this person. He's very open about showing it. We fly over it every year, and they wave. And this is a legal this is a legal growth site.
It is a legal
growth site. They have enough cards to support that grow. So you have multiple people at that site that are designated as persons responsible for the growth site.
Okay. So we said that a grower could only grow for four patients.
Correct.
But we didn't say that all that growers could get together and grow. We didn't say that. Okay. And
sure.
We didn't limit the number of caregivers. Okay.
The thing that you think about, this caregiver at any time, if he was driving down the road, if for 26, whatever 26 times 24 ounces, that's how much that person could legally possess at any time, anywhere in the state of Oregon as currently as the law exists today. We get asked about how many violations statewide are you seeing, and I think, back in 2005 when the meth bill came through, I think everybody realized how difficult it is to collect good data, and there was an effort to, pull out some of the drugs and give them their own statute so that we could get a better idea of tracking this. We have no way of tracking medical marijuana violations. When you're either in or you're out, and when you're outside the act, you just fall into the regular possession, manufacture, delivery of marijuana. So when those arrests show up, we have no way of knowing which ones of those were medical or are non-medical related. But what we can do is we can look at some snapshots of some data from two or three different places so that we can at least get an idea there and draw some conclusions. Down in Douglas County, this is a sketch. This happens. These are all these pins represent sites where violators were prosecuted, and there are 50 of them since January of 06. along the I-5 corridor, mostly, it looks like. OSP, what we did is we also internally have a difficult time with doing that, but what we did is we looked at all of our marijuana cases since 2006, just the ones that involved manufacture and delivery. We didn't look at any of the possession cases. 19% of all of our marijuana investigations, whether it's MCS or DCS crime, involve out-of-compliance cardholders. If you look in Washington County, there's a Washington. They have a drug multi-agency drug team up there. It doesn't count any of the other agencies. Just that team alone had 26 out of compliance OMMA growth sites just in the first 10 months of 2008. And we also, another source of information is Department of Justice collects. Does a lot of analytical work, but one of the things that law enforcement can do is there's what we call crop seizure reports. So when we come across a grow that's any kind of illegal marijuana grow, we fill out this form in terms of where it's at, how many plants and whatnot, and they check a box as to whether or not it was an out-of-compliance card, a marijuana grow site. 2007, 18% of all of the grow card or grow site crop seizure reports that they received were out of compliance cardholders. And again, keep in mind that that's not mandatory reporting. That's just the agencies that are sending that information into to DOJ.
Okay, we're going to have to stop now. We have to be on the floor in 15 minutes. We have to get ready to go on the floor in 15 minutes. We're going to hear for at least an hour on Wednesday. We're going to carry this over, and we're going to limit testimony significantly on Wednesday. Those of you who want to testify will have about a minute and a half to make your statement. We're not going to finish on Wednesday. We're going to have to come back, and I'm sorry, we're not going to take any more testimony today. We're going to have to come back at some point, and we're going to get a product out, because I want to preserve the medical marijuana program. Mm-hmm. I want to preserve it. Mm-hmm. And we have to be careful that we don't abuse it. So, anyway. Yes, you can. Yeah. But it's going to have to be brief.
I promise I'll be out.
Okay. Close the public hearing and adjourn.
Bill, what time on Wednesday?
8 o'clock. 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 8 o'clock.